Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon.
You've been there?
No, but I would.
Welcome, everyone. Anyone here for the first time tonight? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us online for the first time. This is an ongoing weekly meditation group. I've been teaching for a long time, over 20 years, every Monday night on the West Side here in Los Angeles. I like to start class by asking you to talk to each other in service of a core principle in Buddhism is developing community, what we call taking refuge in the Sangha. Sangha is the Buddhist word for community, for people who are practicing this path. And my own experience of being a student of Buddhism for a long time is that it can be quite hard to connect and meet other people if you come and do a silent meditation and then listen to a talk and leave. So I start by getting you to talk to each other. And then if you attend regularly or online, I put you in these breakout rooms. At least you get to talk to each other a little bit, start to meet some of the other students, people here. I try to come up with an icebreaker, a topic for you to talk about that's connected to the topic. Tonight, I'm gonna talk about like 9 or 12 different things. I'm gonna talk about some of the core. We'll see. I have like, maybe it's 12, I might only get through 9 of them, we'll see. But it's, those of you who've studied Buddhism are a little bit familiar, like even with the core Buddhist teaching, which is the 4 Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So in Buddhism, it's all lists. 4 of these and 8 of those and 12 of these. And tonight I'm going to give you 4 lists of 3. The 3 these and the 3 these and the 3 those. And on some level, it's nice that Buddhism is organized into these lists, even though like at first it's like, whoa, this is math. There's a lot going on here. And how do I memorize the 4 Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and all of the different subsections, the 27 subsections of the Eightfold Path? In the beginning, it's a little complicated. And then once you look at it for a while, you're like, oh, I'm glad, because it's kind of easy to memorize that it's in 4 of these and 8 of these and 3 of those. And so I'm going to give you some lists tonight that we're going to talk about. So the topic for your small group is, what's your favorite Buddhist list? What's your favorite? And maybe you're brand new and you have no idea, and that's okay. Just introduce yourself to the people in your small group and say, fuck lists. I don't know. I didn't come here for homework. Or whatever it is, you know, but maybe you have been looking at it. And you're like, I really like how the 4 Noble Truths are laid out or something else. Dependent origination, you know, some of you nerds are like, well, the 12 links of dependent origination are quite interesting. So small groups, go ahead and find 2 or 3 people you don't know. We'll give some meditation instructions for about 30 minutes. Find a way to sit with a posture that is relaxed. Settling, allowing your eyes to be gently closed. Taking a moment to release any unnecessary tension, soften the face, the jaw, the shoulders. The heart, the belly. With each exhale, think about softening your belly, releasing your jaw, so that the body is sitting upright without being rigid, without being stiff, without being tense, trying to release the tension. Just enough resistance to gravity to stay upright without just melting into a puddle. One of the images that's sometimes used is, imagine your skeleton sitting here upright.
Pretty close.
vertebrae stacked, the head upright, the arms resting, and the body, the flesh of the body, hanging loosely around the skeleton, draped over the bones. Soft belly, unclenched jaw. Body breathing its own natural rhythm. You don't need to control your breath for this practice. And establishing an inner attitude of kindness, friendliness, acceptance, the intention to be patient and accepting and kind towards your mind, towards your body, towards your emotions. Mindfulness is non-judgmental, present time, kind awareness. Non-judgmental, present time awareness with an attitude of friendliness towards whatever your mind is up to, whatever your body feels, whatever your heart is experiencing. For the first few minutes of a formal sitting meditation, it's useful to choose an object of awareness to focus on. Usually we start with the breath. Buddha's instructions were something like breathing in, know that you're breathing in. Breathing out, know that you're breathing out. Feel the breath. Receive the changing sensations of each in-breath and out-breath. As we give our attention to the sensations of the breath, we can let everything else go to the background, the thoughts, the other sensations. In this kind of meditation, we're not trying to stop the mind from thinking. But in the beginning, we are trying to stop paying attention to what the mind is thinking about. Foreground of our attention in the body, breathing, thoughts in the background. Some find it useful in early meditation practice to label in as you breathe in and out as you exhale, giving the mind a way to track the focused attention, breathing in, breathing out. Can experiment with that technique, and if you like the labeling, the noting, when your attention leaves the breath, goes into thinking, or a sound takes your attention away from the breath, you can also note that, thinking, hearing. What is your attention, your awareness focused on? Is it the breath or a thought? But choosing to disengage when you get involved in your thoughts, come back to the breath. Keep disengaging from the thoughts about the future, the past. Keep coming back to the present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness of here and now, the body sitting, breathing. Another aspect of mindfulness meditation is inquiry or investigation. Rather than completely shutting the mind off, using the mind to investigate what's happening right now. Even with the breath itself, the Buddha encouraged an investigation of the impermanent nature of sensation. How's the sensations of the breath changing? What can we learn about impermanence, change, through mindfulness of the breath? Begin to expand beyond the narrow focus on the breath to become more inclusive. What else is being experienced in the body right now? Sensations of contact with the cushion, the chair, the posture. So many sensations in the hands and feet, arms and legs, trunk of the body. Paying close attention to how the sensations are changing. The second instruction is to identify, to investigate the feeling tones of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral. What parts of the body feel pleasant, agreeable, comfortable? What parts of the body feel unpleasant, uncomfortable, difficult to bear, painful? how much of the body is neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Including not only physical sensations, but the sense doors, sounds, the impermanent nature of sound, even my voice, the instructions, and your perception of is it pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Including the thoughts, rather than ignoring the mind at this stage, we include, we open, we turn the non-judgmental present time kind awareness towards the mind, towards the thought formations, the plans and memories, desires and aversions, hopes and fears that arise in the mind. What's the feeling tone of the thoughts that are coming through? Are they pleasant thoughts, unpleasant thoughts? Remember the intention to be kind towards whatever you're experiencing. No matter how busy the mind is or uncomfortable the body becomes. Come back to the practice of softening the belly. Relaxing into what's happening. When we identify an unpleasant sensation or emotion or mind state, inclining the heart towards friendliness, towards compassion, trying to be tolerant and accepting of even the painful moments. useful to reflect after a formal sitting, to think back, reflect on what just happened. How many thoughts came through, how many sensations, how much resistance there was, fear, craving for it to be different than it is, or maybe sense of tranquility or acceptance. We learn a lot from the direct experience of meditation, and then we also learn a lot from reflecting on after meditation, recollecting. Even one of the definitions of sati, which we translate as mindfulness, present time awareness, a more accurate translation is recollective awareness. And even though I'm guilty of giving the instruction present moment, present time, the way that our minds work, by the time we identify what's happening, it's already gone. We're actually remembering what just happened. It's somewhat impossible to catch it all in real time. It's sort of like by the time we say, I'm breathing in, you know, that you know, is already kind of happening, and it's already, the breathing out is happening. You're catching it as a process. And so rather than present moment, present time, the unfolding of time, and then recollecting, remembering what just happened. The fuck just happened? I sat here for 30 minutes and tried to pay attention to my breath and tried to be compassionate and tried to not cling and not be too identified with my thoughts. And over the years of practice, you see, oh, I'm getting a little bit better at this, I'm making some progress. I can tolerate being uncomfortable, or I can be less seduced by my plans or my memories or whatever's happening. So your lists for tonight, starting with the big three as kind of the overview of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is broken down into three sections. The Buddhist words are sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila is ethics, a core part of the Buddhist path to freedom from suffering. The Buddhist practice that leads to liberation is the practice of ethical, wise speech and actions and livelihood. So these, the middle section of the Eightfold Path, actions, communication, and livelihood. And so this kind of, it's about how we behave and what we, how ethical we are in our communications, honesty, and how ethical we are in our relationships, relationally, in our actions. There's a whole section in this teaching around avoiding sexual misconduct, being wise and careful and ethical in our intimate, in our relation, sexual, with our sexual energy. And so part of ethics is renunciation. And the Buddha gave five, there's another list. There's, you know, just in the first list of three, ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And the ethical teachings, there's several sections on what is wise, what's ethical communication, wise speech. And then there's five areas of action that the Buddha encouraged. He said, if you want to follow this path as a householder, five precepts. The ethics, Buddhist ethics, are not killing, not lying, not stealing, avoiding sexual misconduct, and not using drugs and alcohol that may lead you to be more likely to lie and kill and sleep with the wrong person. And so sobriety, and lying and killing and stealing and cheating are obviously unethical, right? Taking drugs and alcohol, recreational drug, isn't it's not an unethical thing to do, but it's in support of the ethics. It's one of the renunciations that the Buddha says, in order to really be careful with our speech and our actions, we don't want to put things into our system that would dull our mindfulness, that would block our heedfulness, because we're trying to be ethical and heedful and awake. And so Buddhism is or early Buddhism, or traditional early Buddhism, is a practice of sobriety, whether you're a recovering alcoholic or not. It's a practice of being mindful, and mindfulness necessitates sobriety. So it's thrown in there as part of the ethics, but it's really more in support of the other ethical factors. And being, all of the ethics of Buddhism are connected to the understanding of karma. Karma is the understanding that we live in a realm, a world, an experience of cause and effect. And wise actions and wise speech and wise intentions lead to a positive karmic outcome. And unwise actions and unwise speech and unwise relationship to sex or money or lead to a negative karmic momentum. And so all of the ethics, there's no external judgment. There's no God. The Buddha is not judging you. You're not being ethical for the Buddha. It's all personal responsibility, because this is what will lead to wholesome karma, positive karma. And so if you choose to follow the renunciation, the ethics of Buddhism for yourself, not for the religion, not for the Buddha, not for any sort of external power, but the teaching is, this is what will alleviate suffering in your life. And so then, if you'd like to alleviate suffering, don't lie. Lying will cause suffering. Don't steal. Stealing will cause suffering. Don't cheat. Cheating will cause suffering. Don't use drugs and alcohol, because that will block your renunciation at times. I know there's some people who probably can have a glass of wine and not cheat or lie or steal or be unethical in any way. But it does block mindfulness. So it's put in there of, like, in order to really get free, we need to be mindful as much as possible. And so there's no real place for a commitment to mindfulness and then taking substances that block mindfulness. You're kind of saying, like, I'm going to take a break from my mindfulness by getting high. Even though when you're high, you feel really fucking mindful. It's a false sense of awareness from the Buddhist perspective. Last night I was having dinner with my wife and father-in-law, and he wanted to know. He didn't really have the words for it, but he at one point during dinner, he said, "What is Buddhism? What is your?" He kind of, like, he doesn't even, I don't think he even knows. He kind of knows that I practice and teach Buddhism, but he was like, "Well, your thing. What is your?" What is the, I forget, he was trying to ask, like, how do you judge progress in your thing, in your path? And he used examples of, is it like, going to church, or being holy, or I felt like he didn't really have the language for this, but if he had the language, I feel like he was trying to ask, in Buddhism, is it about how many retreats you do, or how much you meditate, or and one of the things that he did say is, or is it how you behave? And both my wife and I both instantly said, it's about behavior. It's about wise behavior. It's about ethical, wise kindness and generosity and compassion and friendliness. That it's really about behavior more than anything else. Now, I was reflecting on that, and I do think that that's very true. But of course, the second piece, ethics and behavior, And then the samadhi, which is the term that is for both mindfulness and concentration and heart, loving kindness and compassion and forgiveness, all of those are under this samadhi meditation practice. In order to really be kind and loving and compassionate, it's not really just a choice we can make. True compassion isn't a choice we can make, it's an outcome of deep meditative wisdom. And so the meditation supports wise behavior. I was reflecting on, like, I feel like there's people in the world, maybe you know some of them, who are very kind, just naturally kind people, but they're not very wise. They don't have, their kindness isn't necessarily coming from wisdom. And so I think actually you can be kind without wisdom. I'm not sure you can have deep wisdom without a deep meditative experience. Maybe you can, but I have a bias and a Buddhist perspective that says deep wisdom comes from training the mind to see itself clearly. And that it's all inside. It's not knowledge. It's not like I read all of the books and I studied all of the texts and I listened to all of the lectures. Not that kind of wisdom, but internal wisdom that you know directly for yourself that what the books and the scriptures and all that stuff says is true. But it's wisdom directly, not knowledge that you've learned, but meditative wisdom. So I think people can be kind without wisdom. I don't think that anybody that truly has wisdom would be unkind. I think that the outcome of true wisdom, real deep understanding of the nature of things, is going to be friendliness, is going to be compassion, is going to be kindness. And that it's going to be a genuine feeling of friendliness and compassion and understanding that wisdom leads to kindness. On some level or another, leads to friendliness. Like beginning of the meditation instructions, I almost always say, now incline your mind to kindness. Your mind probably naturally isn't going to sit here and be kind, but set that intention. As I sit here and my mind judges and compares and plans and remembers, let me direct it towards trying to be kind. And when I often say, which means accepting of what's happening moment to moment, tolerant of the unpleasant sensations that happen as you sit still for a while, accepting tall, you know, kindness is a term that to me means accepting and kind and friendly and patient and tolerant, and all of those are sort of sub categories of kindness. So the ethics and meditation, and they're connected. You can practice renunciation without meditation. You can say, I'm going to take a vow to not lie or steal or cheat or engage in sexual misconduct or use drugs and alcohol, and you can kind of just be, you could do that. But that meditation leads to those choices not coming from like a rigid attachment to some externally enforced rules, but coming from a place of wisdom that says, I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to steal anything. I don't want to create that negative karma for myself or cause harm to anybody else. That it comes from an intuitive place that's not just because it's prescribed, but it's genuine, it's authentic. The outcome of wisdom, meditation that leads to wisdom, is ethics. Now, it's okay to start. I know for myself, when I started the Buddhist practice, I didn't have ethics. And I started meditation first. And then I kind of tried to say, like, okay, I gotta stop stealing. I gotta stop lying. And I gotta stop, fighting and, violence and sexual misconduct. Like, I came, like many people in our community, from a place of a lot of confusion and addiction and anger and fear. And first I started meditating. The samadhi was the hook for me. And I feel like in the West, that's often true. People get interested in meditation and then maybe get interested in ethics, or maybe never get interested in ethics, but meditate. I remember I was watching some show a few years ago, the show Billions. And as sort of meditation has gained popularity in our culture, it's kind of gotten itself into a lot of television. Like there was just the White Lotus show that a lot of people watch, but Buddhism and meditation. Anyways, on Billions, there's sort of the good guys and the bad guys, and it's all complicated, but they were all meditating. They all had their meditation apps. And you know, they were, you know, turning on their meditation apps. The billion, you know, billionaire guys who are trying to rip everybody off and destroy the world are meditating. No ethics, but like actually maybe meditation will help my greed, help me be a better, more skillful, greedy person. You know, it'll help me relax into my stealing and robbing and cheating. And so, you know, sometimes meditation doesn't necessarily, but the Buddha said, you know, this path, ethics, meditation, lead to wisdom, lead to understanding. The wisdom, and so then, so those three, and wisdom, the next list of three, sila, samadhi, paññā, ethics, meditation, wisdom. Wisdom into the three characteristics. This is your second list, or maybe it's your fifth list by now. The three characteristics of all phenomena, internal, external, all conditioned phenomena, are A, impermanent. There is nothing permanent anywhere from a Buddhist wisdom perspective. There's nothing permanent that happens inside of you, and meditation leads to that direct knowing, wisdom. The more you, even I gave the instruction with the breath, how's it changing? Pay attention. Whatever you're paying attention to is a process of change, is impermanent, is the Buddhist word is anicca, impermanent, transient, changing. Everything that we see, everything that we taste, everything that we smell, everything that we hear, every emotion arising and passing, every thought, there's no permanence in existence. Good news when your experience is unpleasant. Aren't you grateful for impermanence when you're in pain? This shit won't last forever. It'll change, it'll arise, it'll sustain, it'll pass. Or, you know, we kind of are stoked. I'm glad, happy for impermanence right now. When my knee hurts, when my heart is aching, when my mind is attacking. Not such good news when life is pleasant, when everything's going your way. This shit won't last forever. This pleasant experience is also impermanent, will arise and pass. Everything impermanent. It's easy to say, and you know it, right? It's like you say, everybody's like, oh, yeah, okay. Duh, everything's impermanent. But how much of our suffering in our life is because we're clinging, not wanting something to change that's changing, the grief of loss? Part of impermanence says we sort of live in loss. We live in a state of constant loss. You can't keep anything. Everything's constantly changing. And it's hard to have a non-attached relationship to the impermanence and to not take it so personally when it's changing in a way that you don't want it to, when the pleasant thing is leaving, it's passing through. Something that you wanted to keep, when the definition of the first noble truth, the suffering that we experience, the Buddha said one of the ways that we suffer is by losing things we want to keep. We can all relate to that. Like, yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I would have liked to have not lost. Material things, sensual experiences, spiritual experiences. You know, that one meditation you had on retreat in 97? Fuck, I wish I could just live in that. If I could just live in that blissful, spacious awareness. But even that meditative phenomena was impermanent. It happened in 97 or 2007 or 2017 or last week. But it's gone now. It didn't, it's not permanent. It arises, sustains, and passes. Now, with big meditative wisdom experiences, it does leave a knowing. So even though you don't get to live in spacious, non-clinging joy that you had on a meditation retreat or wherever, you remember, oh, that is a potential that came from my heart, that came from my being. I don't have to, I don't get to live in it all of the time, but it is part of what we can access without drugs, what we can access without it being a sense pleasure or a material thing that's making me happen, I'm kind of happy. It's important wisdom. Because so the second part of the wisdom, the second characteristic, everything's impermanent. Because everything's impermanent, non-clinging is our practice, is our goal, is our the wise relationship to impermanent things is let go. Let it be impermanent. Stop. I heard one teacher many, many years ago said, clinging is like playing tug of war. Like you're clinging, like that image of clinging to a rope, like a tug of war, like a rope tug of war. But you're playing tug of war with the universe, and no matter how hard you cling, it's being pulled out of your grasp. And the outcome every time of clinging is rope burns. Anytime we get attached to anything, we're creating suffering for ourselves. And just think of how often we cling. Part of the meditative discipline of Buddhism is teaching us to let go, teaching us to understand the impermanent nature of things and to let it arise and sustain and pass, whether it's painful or pleasant. Let go. So the Buddhist words for these three characteristics are anicca, anatta, dukkha. Dukkha, which I'm going to talk about as a second characteristic, is the same word for the First Noble Truth. Dukkha, which in the First Noble Truth we generally translate as suffering. But here it's the same word, but it's not necessarily suffering because it's saying everything's impermanent. It's saying also everything is dukkha. Not everything is suffering. Here, the more appropriate translation is unreliable or unsatisfactory. It's not all suffering. Sometimes it's joy, but even joyous experience is unsatisfactory because it doesn't last. It's not all suffering, but it is all unreliable because it is all impermanent. It is all unsatisfied. No matter how much pleasantness you experience in your life, it won't satisfy you because it's too transient. It'll pass. You'll experience really pleasant things. And so, yeah, I feel like this is for our community, so many of us recovering addicts, alcoholics. We saw what happened when we tried to chase pleasure and avoid pain and drank ourselves into alcoholism or addiction, trying to constantly cling to and chase pleasure and avoid pain. There's no substance, there's no experience. There's, in Buddhism, we'd say there's no sensual or material source of satisfaction. Nothing will work. No amount of money, no amount of pleasure, no amount of will satisfy the repetitive craving because it's all impermanent. I was playing poker recently with a guy that I play poker with pretty regularly, who's a billionaire. And he was talking about, and he plays fairly low stakes for being a billionaire. I play with him. I don't, it's not a big game, it's a medium game. But he was talking about how he's retired a whole bunch of times. He said, after I made my first billion in my 40s, I retired. He said, but I got so bored being rich. And just playing poker and golf or whatever he was doing, he's like, it just wasn't satisfactory. He's like, I needed, he said, people need something to do that's meaningful. And he's like, isn't it? He's like, and so I keep making more money because that's something to do. But it was just that sort of like the idea. Don't, I have the idea that, like, man, if I had a lot of money, I'd be super chill. I could retire. Don't you feel like, oh, I could totally retire? Like, I'm not, for me, I'm not the best example because even if I retired, I felt like I'd still teach because I, you know, it's not really, it's a job, but it's not really a job. It's more of a calling or something like that. Like, I'd still teach, but that idea that so many, you know, that's so easy to have of like, if I had enough stuff, enough money, enough, I wouldn't work. I wouldn't care about that. I'd just maybe be of service or just, you know, kind of give my money away or whatever, whatever you think you would do. And it was just an interesting example of kind of second noble truth of repetitive craving. I got everything that I thought would make me happy. Didn't really work. I need to keep going. And whether that's people who think I need more money, his case, he's like, I don't need more money, but I need something, you know, to do. And what I do is business, because that's what I like to do. So I just keep doing, making more money, even though I don't even care about it or need it. But it's what I do. So it gives me something to do. Keep starting businesses. Keep starting businesses. Keep making more money. Keep playing poker. The unreliable or unsatisfactory nature of all things. And, you know, I'm throwing these out here as wisdom, but you get to reflect on impermanence in your life, in your internal, in your heart, in your mind, in your world. The unreliable or unsatisfactory nature, again, this is, you know, it's wisdom, it's the Dharma, it's the truth, it's the way things are from a Buddhist perspective. But you get to reflect, oh, is that true in my life? Am I still thinking that there's some place to get that will be satisfactory? Something to get that will satisfy me? Do I still believe that there's some destination that will be happiness? Enough money, enough, the right relationship, the right stuff, the right house, whatever it is in your delusion, in your mind, that says, I would be happy if. Part of the Buddhist wisdom is it won't work if it's a material-based or sense pleasure-based source. That the only reliable refuge, the only reliable is wisdom. Now, if your goal is wisdom, then cool. Because you can actually develop wisdom that's not reliant on sense pleasure or materialism, that will lead to a sense of ease and well-being no matter your house or your bank account or your job or your relationship status. Because it's your being that is the source of your happiness. It's your wisdom. It's not outside of you. It's not. It's the understanding that everything's impermanent and nothing's worth clinging to. It's the understanding that everything is unreliable and not worth trying to take hostage for our happiness. That having been said, and I do feel like this part is an important reminder, still go for it. Have your have our relationships and have our careers and have our material aspirations and, get the stuff that you like and enjoy it with the wisdom of it's not going to work. It's impermanent. It's already broken. There's the famous teaching from Ajahn Chah about his favorite glass. He says, this is my favorite glass, the short of it is. He said, but to me, I enjoy it because it's already broken. I know it's already broken. So taking that wisdom of already broken into whatever relationship, whatever material thing, maybe you want for me, it's like cars and motorcycles, and I like those things. I'm like, okay, but if I can treat this motorcycle as though it's already broken and enjoy every moment with it rather than I'm only happy when it's running correctly. It's already broken. It's impermanent. It's unreliable, especially the kind of motorcycles I like. Very unreliable. Not a big surprise when my low rider breaks down, when my hydraulics go out, or whatever happens. It's unreliable. I didn't expect it to work all of the time. It's impermanent. It's unreliable. It's already broken. The low rider is already broken down. And makes it re make, really changes our relationship to it rather than suffering and grieving and getting angry about things when they break, knowing that it's their nature to be unreliable, to be impermanent. The last piece of the is the hardest to talk about, which is the impersonal. So impermanent, unreliable or unsatisfactory, and impersonal, not self, not personal. There's some part of our biological, evolutionary, survival instinct that is self-centeredness. I, me, mine. Our brain thinks about ourselves, thinks about our, this instinctual, if I had more pleasure, if I had more comfort, then I'd be happy. It's your survival instinct. It's not your fault. It's not our fault that we're self-centered beings, but we are self-centered beings. But we're self-centered beings in a form and a process of being that is impersonal. It's not self. And how much we're identified with our emotions, how much we're identified with our mind states, how much we're identified with our body as who we are, and as a sort of permanent identity rather than a process. Again, a not self is connected with impermanence. If we can see ourselves as a unfolding process, rather than a solid, separate, continuous self. If we can see all of my thoughts and feelings and sensations are arising and passing. And a lot of it is happening all by itself, non-volitionally. When you meditate and you tell your mind to shut the fuck up for a little while, you sit down and you say, okay, I'm gonna meditate. Mind, shut up. And your mind keeps thinking. Who's thinking? What's thinking? I feel like before meditation, my experience, anyways, I don't know about yours, was I thought I was in charge. I thought that I was my thoughts, my mind, some level or another. I walked around believing my views and my opinions and my perspectives and my thoughts and my plans and memories, and I was quite identified with what my brain told me. And I thought, that's who I am. I'm this anger, and I'm this fear, and I'm this insecurity, and I'm these wounds, I'm these traumatic memories. And then the more we meditate, the more we start to see the mind has its own process, its own impersonal kind of programming, and that it keeps thinking. And there's something knowing the mind, there's awareness, there's consciousness, there's what the Buddha called citta, which is like a wise, a loving awareness of the heart-mind process. And that there's a difference between volitional and non-volitional thought. And so much of what's happening psychologically, emotionally, is happening all by itself. We're not in charge. We're not in control. And if we were, don't you think you'd be able to just say, hey, no more fear? Tired of being nervous all the time. Tired of being selfish, self-centered, afraid, resentful. And we start to see in mindfulness, we can't stop the mind's habits. We can't stop the biological craving for pleasure. We can't stop the biological evolutionary process of aversion to pain, resenting those experiences that harmed us, what we call traumatic experiences. You can't just stop your mind from doing that. Just what the mind does all by itself. Just what the body does. The body hates pain. The body loves pleasure. The mind hates pain. The mind hates, loves pleasure. Totally impersonal, instinctual drive living through us. Not self, not our fault, not personal. Anatta is the Buddhist term, not self. And it's the key here is how identified we are, how much we believe the mind, how much discernment we can develop to see what thoughts are trustworthy and what thoughts are untrustworthy. Because the mind is a fucking liar. Have you noticed? Have you even noticed how often you lie to yourself about reality, about who you are? So, for instance, if you ever experience shame about who you are, it's a lie every time. There's no truth to shame, to any kind of thought that says, I'm unworthy, or I'm bad, or I'm unlovable, or I'm. And you know, the human mind loves to do that, loves to experience this level of shame, and it's complete bullshit. There's no truth to it at all. Some conditioned, you know, different conversation of why the mind does that. It does it, but it's a liar. Now, if your mind tells you you're worthy and you're lovable and you're good enough, not perfect. If your mind tells you you're perfect, you're a narcissist. But if your mind tells you you're good enough with your imperfections, and you're acceptable and lovable, wise thoughts, right? So the mind, what we call the mind, the brain, has both wisdom and ignorance. And some of the not self understanding is the impermanent nature, the unreliable nature, and then the discernment of some thoughts are trustworthy and some thoughts are absolutely untrustworthy. And developing that, what are we identified with? How much are we addicted to our minds? Are we identified to, with our thoughts and emotions? When I say mind, I mean both mental thoughts and also emotional, my emotional states. Mind states. So anicca, anatta, dukkha. Sila, samadhi, paññā, ethics, meditation lead to wisdom. Wisdom into the impermanent, impersonal, and unreliable or unsatisfactory nature of all things. Was only six of the nine. So the other three that I wanted to throw out there, I'm gonna give you, I only have a few more minutes, but two more lists of three. The other three we've already been talking about a little bit, and it's the three feeling tones. Within the impermanent nature of all things, everything is perceived as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this is so key for our mindfulness. I don't think you need to trip out too much on the not self. But the practical application of mindfulness is what's happening right now and how does it feel? Remembering that it, the thought, the sensation, the sound, the smell, the taste, the emotion, is arising and is impermanent. But it has a feeling tone. It sounds pleasant or it sounds unpleasant, sounds neutral. It looks pleasant or it looks unpleasant or it looks neutral. It feels every sensation, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And this is really, I think, in some ways, the most important part of our practical application of Buddhist mindfulness. What's happening and how does it feel? Remember that it's impermanent. Keep investigating the impermanence. But this is where so much of our suffering comes because it's pleasant, we cling, we play tug of war. It's unpleasant, we resist, we try to get rid of it, we want to push it away. It's neutral. What's your relationship to neutrality? You ignore it, perhaps. It's boring. Neutrality is boring. Oh, I need pain. Pain's interesting. It'll cause some trouble for myself. Sabotage. So I've already said it some, but I want to end with this and a little bit of. So the last three, and this is not really a typical list. Sila, samadhi, panya, ethics, meditation, wisdom, impermanence, not self, unreliable nature of things, these three feeling tones. Now, here's the cheat sheet. Three wise responses that will end suffering in your life. Non-attachment. Nothing is worth clinging to. Let go all of the time. Letting go is always the right response. And it's very easy to say and very hard to do because we live in a biological imperative that wants to fucking cling and control, and meditation is necessary to learn non-attachment. Let go. And again, you can't just. I made the decision to try to let go decades ago. Decades ago. And over the decades of meditation, I've become a little bit better at letting go, or a lot better than I was in the beginning. But it wasn't a decision that I could make. Meditation, practice, seeing impermanence more and more clearly, seeing the direct experience of suffering when I cling, has helped me learn to be less and less attached. Let go. When it comes to the unpleasant, compassion. Tolerance, mercy, compassion. So much of life is unpleasant. So much of living in a nervous system and a body that's subject to sickness and aging and death, and to live in a world of corruption and oppression and greed and ignorance is so unpleasant so often. Compassion is the only wise relationship to all of the unpleasantness, both internally and externally. And compassion's a much bigger whole topic for discussion, but the simple cheat sheet is try to be friendly, caring, kind, and compassionate towards pain. And, you know, we can't do it. It's, again, it's not a decision that we can just make of like, you know, also when I started getting serious about Buddhist meditation 30-something years ago, I said, okay, I'm going to practice non-attachment. And I'm going to practice compassion. And then realize really quickly, like, can't do that. I hate pain and all of the people in the world that I disagree with. I love pleasure and I want it to last forever. And then slowly over the years of meditation, seeing like, okay, a little less clinging, a little more compassion. And the last one is non-identification, and I just talked about that when it comes to the self and self-centeredness and the self-centered tendency of our human condition. Trying to not take it all so personally and not be so identified. And even this, I think, very Buddhists, maybe other wisdom traditions talk about it too, but of just not being that attached to our own views and opinions and seeing what our perspective is as a view and an opinion rather than the truth. You know how often we get so identified with, like, well, I am right. Even when, you know, the worst part is when you are right. Even when you're right, it's a view, it's an opinion. And clinging to it and being identified with it and needing other people to agree with you and needing to get the praise for being right. So much suffering, so much resentment towards the people that have different views and opinions. And a healthy sense of skepticism towards our own views and opinions. Because remember last year, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, when you held some views that now you look back and you say, I can't believe I believed that shit. I was so mistaken. But now, but now I'm right. I used to be ignorant, but now I'm wise. I used to be wrong, but now I'm right. And we always think we're right at the most ignorant, you know, I don't know. For me, like, I can look back on being a drug addict, being violent, being, and I thought I was doing the right thing at the time. I had it all justified, and I thought, you know, yeah, it's okay to rob these people. It's okay to hurt these people. It's okay to hurt myself like this. I thought I was, you know, doing the right thing at the time. In some level or another, I didn't have much of a moral compass back then. The pain was so much stronger than helping me justify all kinds of ignorance, confusion. So that non-identification with our views, a healthy skepticism of when we think we're right, when we're pretty sure we're right and everybody else is wrong. And there is a place for being right. You know, and there's a place for wisdom, and there's a place for trying to develop an ethical view of the world. And I don't know, there's certain things, like sexism's always wrong, you know, and that's not a view, that's just the way it is. Racism's always wrong. There's, you know, if you have racist views, that's not just you know, it's wrong. you know, so it's okay that you're wrong, but you're wrong, right? It's okay, you know, it's like, no judgment that you're a complete nincompoop, idiot, you know, racist fool. But you're wrong, right? So there is right and wrong, right? Like, so when we're talking about views, but it's just how much do we suffer about being right? How identified with like, I'm right and everybody else, you know, needs to be right too. Needs to have wisdom too. Okay, there'll be a test next week on the three characteristics, three wise responses, three aspects of the Eightfold Path, ethics, meditation, wisdom, impermanence, unsatisfactory, impersonal nature of things, and the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral perception of everything, which leads to a Buddhist practice, a wise practice of just trying to be compassionate towards the pain. Keep trying and keep failing, but keep trying. Keep trying to let go and failing, but keep trying to let go. Keep trying to not take it all so personal and failing at that, but keep trying. And we slowly, gradually make progress over the years. So I offer you these teachings for your contemplation, your reflection, and you get to figure it out for yourself, whether it's practical and applicable and true. And it's one of the things that I love about Buddhism is that although there's all of these teachings of what's true and what's not true and how to get free, and but it always comes back to do as you see fit. You get to figure it out for yourself. Here's some guidance, here's some suggestions, here's some teachings, but you get to figure it out on your own. We'll leave it there for tonight. Some announcements is we're going to do a day long here. When is it, Sebastian? 27th, which is what, next weekend? Weekend after next? In 2 weeks, I'm going to do a day of sitting and walking meditation, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. here. It's by donation. There's a suggested donation. I'm actually doing registration through the Refuge Recovery, my other organization, but I do it here at Against the Stream. Even if you're not in recovery, you're welcome to come and meditate for us. I do that because I'm going to do it on Zoom for the Refuge Recovery community. But all of the Against the Stream people, even those of you not in recovery, not blessed with addiction, you're also welcome to join us for the day of sitting and walking meditation on the 27th. You can register through refugerecovery.org for that. Welcome to come in person, and I'll also do it on Zoom. It'll be like this, where it'll be hybrid, so people can do that. The Joshua Tree Retreat, which is May 13th through 18th, looks like it's sold out. I'm trying to negotiate with the center some more beds, so that, because there's a waiting list now and there's more people that want to come. If you haven't registered wanted to come, get on the waiting list. You go to the Against the Stream and get on the waiting list through the website. Try to register and it'll put you on the waiting list. And then if we can open up some more beds, we'll be able to do that. One of the things they said is that we used to be able to have really big retreats at this place, partially because we could do camping. Camping is now not allowed, but they said they could probably allow some car camping. You can't set up a tent there, but people who have RVs or want to sleep in their vans or cars or might be able to expand the numbers for car campers. And there's like a shower and stuff that you can use. So that's coming up. And then the last thing is, I'm taking a group of people to Sri Lanka in the fall, November 10th through 24th, where we're going to do this Buddhist pilgrimage. It's going to include some silent meditation retreat time and some beach time and some time at an elephant sanctuary and some time at some ancient temples and some time shopping in the markets. And it's kind of this, I've been for the last 2 or 3 years taking groups to Asia. We went to Thailand. We went to India. This year I'm going to Sri Lanka. And it's a mixture of travel adventure and living with community and doing a little bit of retreat time. And that's open for registration also on the Against the Stream website. Did I forget anything, Sebastian? Oh, yeah, Donna. Donna is the Buddhist word for donation, for generosity, for supporting Against the Stream, supporting me as a teacher. The suggested donation for dropping in on Monday nights is $25. If you can give $25, please do. If you're financially not able to make that kind of donation, give whatever's appropriate to you. But it's, I think it's important to give something to kind of know that you're, you know, donating to this organization and to this community. And as I said, I've been doing this group for over 20 years, and we've had a meditation center here in Los Angeles because people donate and support it, and it continues. I like to think of the pay it forward model. We're here tonight because of all the people in the past that donated, and then the donations that you give tonight will keep us here in the future. That sort of paying it forward, rather than fee for getting out of the capitalist fee for service. Like, oh, that Dharma talk was like a $7 Dharma talk. Get out of that mentality and just supporting the Dharma rather than how much you enjoyed the class or didn't. Just supporting the center, supporting the Dharma. May any goodness that comes from our practice and discussion be shared with all beings in existence. May each one of us get as free as possible. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet. Good to see everybody. Thanks for coming out. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.